Food Talk with Mike Colomeco has been brought to you by Cento, Calavita, and Wines of Portugal.
Hi, this is Celia Cutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Folks, welcome to Mike Colomeco's Food Talk here. Happy New Year, everybody. You guys can leave the cans on if you want. You can hear yourself. I'm still aware of them. Anyway, sorry. Inner shop talk here. Hope everybody had a great New Year, Christmas, all that stuff. We did. What did I do? The usual stuff. You know, Christmas was a big piece of roast meat with a giant roasty potato. My son came down to give me a ride down from New York, and he actually brought wine for a change. He contributed something. Wait, yeah, 25 awesome. Years old. Took 25 years. This kid bring something to the table besides wrecked cars and bills. Yeah. Two good bottles of wine. Brought down a Sancerre. So he lives in Queens now, and he discovered a wine shop that he wanted to introduce me to. I'm like, dude, you don't think I know about Flatiron? I know about Flatiron Wines. Great wine shop. Like, Broadway and 22nd, really good selection. He brought a beautiful Sancerre down from there and a really good Cru Beaujolais that was bio that was super good. So
awesome. Sounds
yeah,
great.
Yeah. And I had a giant roast tri-tip I got from Florence Meat. I love that butcher on Leroy Street. Great guy. Or Jones or whatever it is. Old New York school butcher. And I want to give a shout out at the end of the year. There's a lot of press, of course. The food critics do their end of the year stuff. Eater, New York Mag, New York Times, of course, which is, I suppose, the big gorilla still in the room. And congratulations for Drew at Petard and Marcus and Jonathan, topping off that list of best restaurants of 2014. Great turnaround from the Corton space, which was a great restaurant, but I think Petard's much more approachable. Have you been yet, Curry?
We ate there and saw Drew and Marcus, and it's funny because I ate at a table that was in the place where the Garmanger used to be, where I worked with David Boulay. And I don't want to say what year.
Yes, we know. The 1987?
87, that's
87,
right.
87, thank you. Now, I keep forgetting, you actually got here before I got here. Let me introduce my guests. Curry Heffernan, who's been on the show before. You might know him from a whole lot of places. If you watch TV, he's been a judge on Top Chef. He'll be a judge this Wednesday on
this
the show?
This Wednesday on Top Chef, yep.
The old friend of Tom Colicchio's. They go fishing together. I bring him on here all the time to talk about all the stuff we love, especially seafood. He's a kind of a passionate water guy, lives in Manhattan and
Sag Harbor.
And Sag Harbor, that's right.
Sag Harbor, where he stand-up paddles and fishes and kind of like, I suck at stand-up paddling and I suck at surfing and I'm still trying, but I swim in the ocean. So that's my superpower.
You're a rock star in the ocean.
I don't know about that, but it's absent the ability to stand up on a board and drop it on a wave, I'm like, well, at least I can swim.
I can clam, and I brought you, I did clam
at some
on
point,
one of these big moon tides.
Yes.
And I got the clams and I smoked them myself and I made you a smoked clam dip.
So we've got fresh clams out of the water, and it was big lunar tide was last weekend, right?
Yeah,
big full moon.
Yeah, yeah.
Big tidal swing. We also have Powell Bryan. Am I pronouncing your name right?
Yeah, you got it.
Who's
way to
working
go.
On something with Curry that we're going to talk about in a couple of minutes. But let's just segue right in. Anyway, congratulations to Drew Petard. I'm glad you've been. I just love it. It's so, they're really nailing it.
Yeah.
I love the food. I think Marcus is doing it. Jonathan's.
Smart, accessible.
Yeah. Fun.
Yeah.
And I think 55, 65, 75, two course, three course, four course, which is really a fairly priced tasting
correct.
Menu.
Yeah.
Contra's got a great tasting menu for 55. Lower East Side, totally different scene, great food. But I mean, I think they hit a price point that's great. Marcus is killing it in the kitchen. Super wine list, everything you'd expect from Drew and the pros.
Also, I would add Upland to that list if you haven't been.
I haven't
Justin
been.
Is
no, another, I know Justin. Justin's a beast.
He's a beast, quite
I'm
literally.
I'll tell you why I'm
big
holding
fisherman.
Back. Tell you why I'm holding back. I didn't know he's a big fisherman. He's worked in great kitchens. I know he's got chops. But, okay, and this is in quotes, it's a Stephen Starr restaurant. And isn't it?
It is. It is.
And Stephen Starr, I don't want to. This is not what I do for a living. I've never done it. But, you know, he's a guy that does big format restaurants. He tends to give them big pushes in the beginning and then get other ideas. I hope that's not what happens here. I hope he doesn't give him free reins. Hope the food's not great for the first 5 months. And then he looks at the food cost and says, we're not making money. I need a burger. I need this. I need that. I need all this stuff. And the place goes to shit. So right. Let's wait. I mean, Stephen Starr's a big guy in Philadelphia, a big player, really, period. But, you know, kind of in that Chattero Hansen mold. If you'll forgive me for
not at all
painting
no,
them in
that
those
is,
broad brushes. you know.
That's the way of our business. So yeah. what are you gonna do?
But you're right, and I've heard, but everyone I've said, chefs included. Chris Jackal was in a couple of weeks ago. Chris, you know, from all on the Chris was saying
Chris used to be my sous chef at 11 Madison.
Damn, G. See, everybody knows everybody. Everybody knows everybody in this business. That's funny. So talk about Hooked on Seafood, which I have still apologies. I am like a Luddite and kind of special ed when it comes to TV these days. I live in Manhattan and Cape May, so I have two different services. Two remotes that look the same that have different buttons, and it always takes me like jet lag. It takes me like 3 days wherever I'm going to realize which remote I have and then which on demand service, because they're not the same. Well, one of them's Verizon Fios, one of them's Comcast.
You need your 25-year-old to help you come in.
No,
you
do it
a couple
son,
of seconds.
My son, I got that Amazon Fire Stick TV thing. I got it like a month ago, and I haven't even played with it yet because it's like I know it's going to be like an all weekend thing, and I'll probably just lose everything. I'll probably put it in the back of my TV and not be. And my kid texted me the other night. He says this thing's amazing. It's so easy. You're such a retard. I'm like, yeah, I know.
Thank you.
Come to New York and install it on my New York one. Now do me a favor. Shut up.
Hooked on Seafood was part of a six-part series on Nat Geo called Eat, the Story of Food. And they interviewed a number of food personalities, chefs. They pulled historical data. They had kind of, you know, the whole sort of gamut of food encompassed in these six episodes. And the episode that I was chosen for was called Hooked on Seafood. Surprise, right? But it was just such an easy and natural process. You know, a lot of TV is kind of contrived.
Yeah.
And they just said, go, put me in front of a camera, and we just hit it off and knocked off all these incredible, you know, ideas. And then I said, listen, if you really want to see it, you've got to come out to Sag Harbor and see it. You know, and it was in August. They said, okay. So of all the people on the show, I'm the only one who got this sort of in the field time. Went out fishing. We caught the Northern Stargazer, which I think you saw on Facebook.
I think I won the few that I did it. Everybody
one of the
was
few
that
I did it.
Because we have those in Cape May. They're bottom feeders. You must have been on the bottom.
Well, I fished this spot in Cedar Point 15 times a season for 6 years. Never caught one
that
of these
fish.
Things except when the cameras were rolling.
That's we have them in Cape May. They're bizarre. They're little. I don't even know what to describe.
No,
them.
mine was
that
24
inches. Wow.
And the head is electrically charged.
Yeah.
And I got a little shocked.
Which is weird.
Very weird. Weird in so many ways. So we caught that, went clamming. We did some spear fishing. It was just this sort of the garden was full of tomatoes and herbs and eggplants.
You're still eating stuff from your garden now. Maybe still, not after this week.
No. I think last weekend was it. But still.
But that was crazy.
Yeah. The kale is still beautiful.
I saw those pictures because you're active on Facebook showing all the stuff you're doing at home.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Kale, you were clamming.
Kale and clams in December. Come on.
So they went out. Rolled cameras, got on the boat, and you just went fishing.
Went fishing, came back, did this sort of little trash bouillabaisse thing, you know, with sea robin and clams. I got this. We got blue crabs last year that had to be 7-inch carapaces. I mean, like, they were, like, scary. Like, do not mess with these things. You'll lose a finger. Crazy big blue crabs. Awesome.
Delicious.
American eel. Just this perfect little, like, everything you could ask for in a bouillabaisse. There it was. Boom.
So people can watch this by Go. It's because now it's aired already in Premiere.
Nat
so
Geo.
You go to Nat Geo on demand. Geo Hooked on, and the name of the series was
Eat, the Story of Food,
and then find Hooked on Seafood.
Hooked on Seafood.
All right. Now, breaking news. You're working on something else. Talk to me about this idea.
Okay. So
this other show. Sorry.
Other show. That's okay. As you know, I'm insanely passionate about seafood.
Yeah.
You know, have rallied to the cause of sustainable seafood. Was just in Monterey at the beginning of December,
yep.
You know, working with a bunch of chefs on how, you know, their Seafood Watch program, which for my mind is the best tool for determining sustainability.
Great website. BlueOcean.org? No.
Monterey Bay Aquarium.
.org.
Yeah, Seafood Watch.
If you just put
Seafood Watch into the App Store, it'll come right up.
And it's alphabetically lists every fish that's going to be available on your diet. It's got color-coded flags.
Correct.
Tells you what's sustainable, what isn't, mercury. But pretty much every issue that they cover, and I have to say 99.9% of what I agree with. It's a great source.
Yeah. Except for striped bass, and I'm working on them on that.
Stop eating striped bass. Let's stop fishing. I mean, give them three. It's crazy, the stocks, right? I see them on menus all the time.
Yeah, 3 years ago, I would have said great choice, local, it's plentiful.
No.
What I've seen,
no.
There's a few big ones. There's no small ones.
Yeah.
And what's going to happen in the next 3 months is that Virginia and Maryland are going to open up, and they're going to be killing those massive, pregnant fish. You'll see them in the markets everywhere, especially in Chinatown, with these massive bellies. And you're like, there is the future. You're just eating the future, you know, and it's sad and, you know.
Well, especially for you, you spent so many years out there, you know, catching and release, catch and cook when they were plentiful and abundant, and you've really been one of the first people that was sort of touting this change in the population that you've been seeing, right?
Absolutely. Well, we saw them drop in the 80s, and we saw them pick back up again.
Right.
And they
picked back up because of good federal management practices. So that it can work.
Worked with scallops. It's worked with a bunch of
fish.
It's
worked very well with scallops. Yeah. Scallops is the number one, you know, crop on the East Coast now. It makes New Bedford is the highest producing seafood port in the country
because scallops went up. Wholesale scallop prices are through the roof, as high as they've ever been historically, because the Alaskan fisheries always beats New Bedford because they just do. The past 2 years, New Bedford has come in number one dollar-wise because of scallops. They live and die on that.
Yeah.
52 million pounds a year we harvest off the Atlantic, the coastline where we are from. Northern Carolina is up through New England. Cape May's big scallop.
Big scallop.
But you're right, and I think part of the trouble with stripers is that tension, too, between the commercial fisheries and the sport fisheries.
Well, it's 65-35, recreational commercial, so it's not so much the commercial guys.
Yeah, it's sport fisheries.
It's sport fishermen and poachers and a lot of things. But if they were off menus, a lot of that would just go away.
But talk to me about the show concept that you're pitching with your producer who's sitting with us, and I'd love to hear this because it's so nice to see people trying to do and hopefully selling it, doing good TV, doing good work, telling good stories, not just fake stuff. Because so much of you're in TV, so much of what you see is just stage. I mean, my kids watch TV shows, and I'm like, I know how they shot that. It's fake. The producer's telling them, we need an argument here. We need to fight, create some tension, throw some stuff around. We need you to cry. You know,
conflict, controversy.
Every couple of minutes, we need conflict. Just manufacture it. We have a couple of pizzas, so if there's moments here when there's silence, if there's moments here and there's silence and the sound of people chewing, forgive us. This show's live out of Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This are some of the best pizza I've ever had, and it's a cold day. It's been a really cold week. It just seemed like we needed pizza in our lives.
So and here it is. Thank you.
So one of you guys, somebody start eating, someone talk. Let's take turns. But tell me about whoever wants to pick it up. Talk about the concept for the show.
Real quick, I've dubbed it as, imagine Dangerous Grounds meets River Monsters. So a show where you go out and work on sourcing and come up with new ideas and new venues. And, you know, it's all about fish. It's all about these, you know, working with commercial fishermen, you know, showing them that species they may have been throwing back are actually valuable and well cared for, more valuable than perhaps the species that they're targeting. So it's just a matter of creating a mindset and a market. And the company that Powell and I have started is called Wild Fish Direct at wildfishdirect.com. And we're going to create this sort of pipeline that gives these commercial fishermen a new venue to sort of channel this great stuff to the rest of the country.
Right, because it all sort of starts with this sort of problem that we have right now where most of the seafood that we consume here in the States is imported or it's farmed.
It's crazy.
80%
of the seafood, over 80% of the seafood America eats, we import, which is nuts. And it's salmon, shrimp, tuna. Bing, bing, bing. It's nuts. I mean, we're just in love with those fish.
And 50% of the best seafood that we produce goes abroad.
I know. I live in Cape May, so the big commercial fishing port. They're selling mackerel. They're selling squid across the boats to Europe. And the West Coast used to sell albacore tuna, line-caught albacore from San Diego and those waters, flash frozen to Europe, and they would can it and sell it back to the United States in those beautiful jars.
Same thing happens with the squid. You get Montauk squid caught, frozen, shipped on a container ship all the way to China, where it's processed,
nuts.
Who knows how,
yeah.
Shipped back clean as Montauk squid to Montauk.
Go figure.
Yeah.
I know a lot of the Alaskan
crazy
salmon
thing
gets
is,
cut in China, too.
It's cheaper. There's only one reason they do that. It's cheaper.
This is the sound of clam dip. That's not clam dip. And kettle cooked potato chips. Thank you.
That is lovingly prepared clam dip, too. I had some yesterday.
I'm going to go silent and eat clams. So you guys talk about the show. Talk about
sure.
We have the idea. Now, how can, will this, give us the website again.
It's wildseafooddirect.com.
No. Wild Fish Direct.
Oh, what did I say?
I don't know. I don't pay attention.
You said
fish.
Wild Seafood Direct. It's not Wild Seafood. It's wildfishdirect.com.
I had pizza in my mouth. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's right. It's distracted. You can't put food
that's
in front
right.
of the guy.
We can't. Lutz is right. We're all drooling.
He's a food expert. You know?
Consumers can buy this, or is it wholesale? Is this aimed at consumers?
It'll be both. Okay. It'll be both. I mean, predominantly in the beginning, it's, you know, two restaurants – you know, to get this in front of people. And you know, again, the concept being that, you know, we eat such a small portion of what's in the ocean and what we have right on our shores just because we're told that we can only eat these certain fish. And as Carrie would point out, that's just simply not the case. I mean, for many, many years, he's been harvesting locally fish and all over the country, different species that everybody says, oh, you can't eat that. You can't eat a Jack Crevalle. You know, you can't eat a bluefish, you know, where you're not going to like it very much.
And yeah, bluefish crudo on this Facebook page, which I must say I'd never even thought of. And you said it was killer good.
I did.
You bluefish. You caught it fresh, bled it.
Yep. Iced it right away in a saltwater slurry. So we had bluefish, fluke, sea bass, and porgy. And we did them all blind and asked people to rate them. And everyone would have thought, well, the fluke crudo, that's the best thing. That's the best on the menus. And then black sea bass, well, that's extraordinary. That should be number two. And then porgy, I don't even know. And bluefish, definitely not. It was the inverse relationship. It was bluefish number one, right. Porgy number two, and then fluke and sea bass three and four.
And I saw that porgy. It was really fatty. That was an interesting porgy. I saw that cut that you had that fillet out, and I'm looking at that.
Well, the porgies that I caught all summer in October just decided to fatten up for the winter.
Yeah,
and they were like these little bellies off bluefin or a farm-raised salmon. They were just loaded and luscious.
And you know, I think that kind of speaks to the point of, you know, one of the other points that Carrie and I talk about all the time, which is eat what the sea gives you. You know, if the sea's giving you a load of fat porgies, those can be delicious.
Delicious, dude. Scup is the other name for those?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Well, Powell's point is exactly right. I think we have to just look at it not as this, like, supermarket where we can go and look, finally find the aisle where the fish that we want are. We got to look at it as a farmer's market, or the way the Europe, you know, in Marseille, a bouillabaisse was whatever the guy caught. That's what you ate. That's what you made it from.
You go to Europe a lot. I go to Europe 3-4 times a year, have for the last 30 years, and I'm a nut for markets. I always go to the fish markets. And it's basically, the fishing industry is there, is really small boats. Sometimes it's a one-man boat, often two- or three-man boats. They go out at night. They go out at night with a light that they hang over the side, a purse seine net, whatever, whatever, some lines they'll drop. And the fish markets are just full of whatever came out of those waters 12 hours ago. And some of it's, I mean, some of it's bad news because they got baby fish that they're selling. I mean, in that sense, I'm not going to defend them, just to kill their own waters. But they eat everything. They're so much more wide open. They're just looking at if it came. And I've said this too, and you guys will agree. So I fish in Cape May. I'm not such a good sport fisherman, whatever. But I fish, and I'm watching these guys throw stuff back, and I said, no. You know, I don't mean catch and release like that smart. I mean stuff they consider junk.
Right.
Sea robin.
Exactly. Skates,
typical bycatch, because you got clam on a hook on the bottom. You're fishing for a striper. You catch your skate. You think you have a striper, but you know three reels in it isn't, because it's just dead weight. Hard to get the hook out of those little suckers' mouths. And like, don't throw that out. Give that to me. I'll take it home.
Right.
I love skate.
Right. It can be wonderful. When I was in Monterey with all these chefs last month, I made a point. I said, listen, I'm going to go diving, because I do a lot of diving as well, under the pier here. And I'm going to see what I can find. And from that, we're going to make something. So I've got this room full of chefs.
Wow.
And I end up with some seaweed, some tiny octopus, something called a sea hare, a keyhole limpet, all these things that pretty much hadn't been eaten very much in the past 20 years.
Except by other fish.
Certainly not in the consumer market.
Absolutely. Not even to these chefs, and some of them were California-based, had never even seen some of this stuff.
Right.
So we had almost no time to prepare it. I put it all in a pot with the seaweed, a little bit of herbs, a leek, brought it to one boil, let it sit, went to our conference, came back in 5 hours and said, what do we got? And some of it was not great, but some of it was mind-blowing and extraordinary. And these guys, you know, we're talking about Michael Cimaruzzi from Providence Restaurant in Los Angeles, maybe one of the premier seafood chefs in the country, were just like, who knew?
Yeah.
So it's there. I mean, seaweed, in fact, is going to be all of our futures, and I think we should just sort of, like, embrace that.
I told Carrie he needs to crack the code on the jellyfish too, because they're with the seaweed, they're the last ones that are going to be left in the ecosystem.
Jellyfish are some of the first ones in the ecosystem around forever.
Exactly, first and last.
Yeah,
and like the cockroach maybe,
and the horseshoe crab and the white shark, 300 million years older than the Atlantic Ocean. But
yeah, I love horseshoes. We used to have them in Cape May. They crawl out of the water. They're
used
cool
to.
As yeah, I know. Less and less. I know they get chewed up. They use for bait. It's sad.
Medical research bait. And
well, actually, one of my sons, the medical research, I does she kill them? She pulls the blood. I think she puts
the
blood
back. No, they're supposed to release them, but some of them die.
Because it's
copper-based blood?
Sterile. It's clear and sterile.
It's clear and sterile, and there's something, because I know one of my sons...
I think you might be right about the copper.
It's copper-based or something. It's copper-based. She pulls it out, does some centrifuging, puts it back in, and she catches and releases them. Yeah. She lives on the Delaware Bay. That's where her house is, and that's what she does for a living. It's crazy. Yeah, those things look like little dinosaurs coming out of the water.
Yeah, and I mean, think about, like, that's a perfect example of what do you do with this thing, and then you find suddenly there's a use for it. On the flip side, like, Carrie and I know a bunch of commercial fishermen that tell us all the time that they're out there fishing for their target species, you know, which they're only allowed so much of whatever, and they're not allowed to do anything with the bycatch
because their permits are for one thing.
Right.
Yeah. So they can't. So they end up throwing back just all this dead bycatch.
Right. And most bycatches ends up dead. If it doesn't come on the boat dead, it's so beat up that by the time they throw it back, it dies.
It's not making it. No.
Yeah.
And you know, and so, you know, to be able to take that, which is perfectly edible, a lot of it. I mean, to your point, some of it's not, and that's the whole, you know, that's where all the research is going, and that's what a guy like Carrie is great for. He'll, you know, get into each fish and see if he can figure out some way to prepare it to make it palatable. And I would say 9 times out of 10, or at least 8 out of 10, you've been successful at it. I mean, and a lot of times you've been surprised by it, right?
Well, I mean, actually, the bluefish is a great point. I mean, that's a fish that Americans have thumbed their noses at for years because it's fishy and it's dark and all the things that we're supposedly afraid of. And
well, it was badly taken care of and it became soft. You know, it was not only just the reputation of the fish; it was not a noble fish like the striped bass, but it was also they said, "Well, I'm just going to catch a dozen of these things, leave them on the deck in the sun, flopping around." Because they have no value. And if people look at it differently and say, if you took care of that fish, I will give you more money for it. You know, that's the mindset we have to... I mean, each of these things that comes out of the ocean is a precious resource.
I think the education, to your point, and congratulations on the show. I mean, I saw the tease on Curry's phone, this 5 or 6 minute reel. It's gorgeous. I mean, high def, beautiful, great action. That shot with the spear behind the spear gun.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, how long did it take to get that shot? I mean, to get clear water, no turbidity, a fish on the other end of it. Great work.
Big one.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's good looking stuff.
Yeah, that was an absolute blast. And I mean, we shot that actually in Panama in the Darien jungle, just off the coast. And to your point, like sort of the locals were just kind of taking everything they catch and they just eat it. You know, whatever it is, whatever they get on any day, they're just going to eat it. You know, I mean, also to your point, like some of it's undersized and there's zero management.
Right.
You know, we had the hardest time even finding statistics for, you know, a lot of Central and South America, you know, while as we're going through trying to figure out where we're going to go or what, you know, not only domestically, which our show is going to be domestically based because there's enough issues here in the U.S. But, you know, while we're over, you know, overseas, it's just, you know, you see all these problems and really some of the biggest lacks of sort of enforcement is internationally. I mean, domestically, we have a much better situation.
We have the most enforced 200 from the coastline 200 miles out is the most enforced fisheries on the planet.
Correct.
It's managed. We're doing it. I mean, I know there's that tension between the government and the fisheries, but it's really well managed. And for the most part. But we then there was just some sad news the other day. I think you sent me the link, or somebody else. I saw it in a couple of places that but the cod count, the cod. Yeah. But the, I mean, we are just looking at the depletion of cod stocks.
Yeah, who thought it could get worse?
Yeah, I mean,
but there's good news. 15 years ago, too. There's good news. The ground fishery for rockfish in California, which was closed for years because of bad methods of harvest, has actually been open in certain areas. So there's black sea bass is well managed. Fluke is on the rise because of good management. Scallops.
Yeah,
or a huge success story.
Yep.
Lobsters are actually so successful, it's actually a problem.
It's beating down the price.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
So there's, you know, and the reason the lobsters are so prevalent is because there's so many fewer cod.
Yeah.
Cod used to eat the lobsters.
Well, and the same thing, too, as the cod, you know, are on the wane, other species are prevalent and abundant, and they're growing and flourishing. And, you know, the whole Maine fishery is a perfect example of a place that for ages has been existing off this cod fishery. I mean, the Vikings came over, right? They were drying their cod, you know, salting their cod.
And the Portuguese. I mean, the whole New Bedford fisheries is all
absolutely
ex-Portuguese families that came over here 100 and some years ago as they ran out of cod going up to the northern, to Finland and the Russian fisheries, and they turned to Iceland, and then just ended up coming to America.
They've been killing those cod for centuries.
Yeah, because they don't have them. It's funny. It's the national fish of Portugal, and they don't have cod in Portugal. They never have.
Right.
It's crazy.
I mean, I was bluefin tuna fishing, believe it or not, out of, I know this is, silence comes to the room because that's a scary subject. We didn't catch any, by the way, out of New Bedford, and the number of ships that are tied up and massive, big, very capable commercial fishing vessels every single day of the week that we were there.
And to your point, I interrupted you, pal, but yeah, the outside of 200 miles, we have these giant factory fishers that are just they process on board. We don't even know what they're purse sanding. We don't know what they're doing. They've got airplanes working with them to spot. I mean, our ability to catch fish has far exceeded, and our appetite for them has
And now you're sort of getting to the point with some of these tuna fisheries where they're harvesting juveniles.
Yeah.
So they're not even spawning, you know, they're not even in that year class where they're spawning. So they're getting them before they're even reproducing, which is just, you know, because that's all that's left. You know, that's all they're seeing. You know, it's a tough situation.
It's sad. And so, you know, the bigger picture is I look at it from macro to micro. I mean, my micro is my little bay in Sag Harbor. And it used to be full of stripers in the spring, and now it's less so. So what do I do? How did the Bonnikers, the Shinnecock Indians who live there, how did they get through the winters? Well, you look small. You start eating clams. You start eating varieties of mussels you may not have chosen as first. You have boom and bust years of scallops. You look at the seaweed. You look at the seagrasses. You look at the whole picture and see how can I responsibly take, you know, sustenance from this. And actually, as a chef, it is so much more interesting and challenging when you have to cook little stuff. You've got to cook with seaweeds. You've got to use these things that you are perhaps not familiar with. It's not just like, okay, I got that beautiful slab of tuna.
Yeah, well,
which way
right.
am I going to slice,
correct,
slab,
right.
sear, and right. season it?
Right.
Boom, done.
Right.
You know, you aren't challenged that way as a chef. And it's much more interesting to sort of live off that land for a little bit and sort of see and you know, the great thing that I always find is the humility, you know, when you're out there. Like, imagine like today. You're a fisherman.
Yeah, it's...
And you've got to make your living.
Right, the air temperature is 10 to 14 degrees. The winds blow, especially out there, the winds blowing 20, 25 miles an hour. The ocean temp's probably in the low 40s.
Right.
It's just nasty. Your hands are freezing. Everything that's landing, even that salt water that's landing on the deck, it's freezing. It's crazy. Your face is falling off. Your hands are falling off.
So what do you do? You set traps, you go out and get them the next day. You work on different species, and hopefully, you know, they're looking at something called the cancer crab, which I think is a variant of the Jonah crab. You know, there's a new fishery. There's
New England?
Yeah, New England, yeah. So surprisingly, there's also cancer crab on the West Coast. Besides, obviously, the porgy, the skate. Skates are actually a little bit in trouble, so I wouldn't push the fishery on them.
Yeah, there's a couple of different types of skates, too. We get them confused.
You know, and also to sort of, you know, throw a counterpoint to what Carrie's saying. He's saying, you know, sometimes you go small, and other times you look in another direction. So, like, for instance, right now, with all the protection, and this is totally going to be a taboo subject right now, but...
Goliath grouper?
No, not quite that, but the shark population down all throughout Florida is off the charts. You know, the spear fishermen, the commercial spear fishermen are out there are seeing more than they've ever seen because they needed to be protected and they were protected and now they rebounded to an extent where you start to say, well, maybe this is, you know, a viable resource.
In certain
resource
species,
again.
Right, within certain species.
Right, exactly.
Right. So that's the biggest, that's the biggest, for shark attacks for open water swimmers, Florida's number one. That's right. Everyone thinks it's good. Australia, it's the West Coast, a great way to know it's Florida. If you're an open water swimmer, bull sharks and a couple of the other species down there take swimmers every year.
Even, you know, while we were shooting my last show, which is called Catching Hell, it's actually on right now. They're rerunning it. But it was about the commercial spear fishermen in the Gulf. Very small group of guys. You know, it's very difficult to do this. They go down 130 feet below the surface, and these guys are, you know, shooting grouper and snapper and all the other fish that you are eating in many restaurants. And, you know, while we're shooting that show, you've got these, you know, I would say the bull shark we weren't seeing as much, but we were sandbars everywhere. You know, I mean, just, and they're super aggressive, and they're packs of them. You know, little six footers, but I mean, they're
little six footers.
Yeah. I should say to those guys, they're little compared to the bigger bull sharks. You know, to me,
But you're 9 hours from shore.
Yeah.
a little shark bite could be fatal.
No, that's absolutely right.
You don't have to get your leg taken off. You don't have to get, you know, consumed by
the animal. Like Harrison Ford said at the end of Mosquito Coast, you know, you want everything to be all right angles, and then you get out in the wilderness and you realize that you slip on, you know, injure yourself, cut yourself on an opening can of tuna, and that's it.
Yeah.
You're done.
Yeah. Yeah.
But to back to the point, it's, you know, it's looking at, I think, all, what the alternatives are that are out there. There's an abundance of life. There's over 1,100 species of fish, you know, in our domestic waters here. And we eat, we're so focused on marketing these 10 fish or these 5 fish or these 3 fish or whatever it is. And you don't realize that there's a gazillion other species out there. And if we can just spread that out, like Carrie was saying, eat what the sea gives you, you know, spread it out so that we're not just depleting one thing completely until there's nothing left. It can be a healthier situation for not only the ocean, but also the commercial fishermen and for people in, you know, in restaurants that are consuming these.
And chefs like you and TV guys like you, and I guess me with whatever platform I have, you know, I think it has to come from chefs down to the consumer. They've got to start seeing it on menus.
Right.
The public's acceptance, the trends have to start from the top and trickle down. This idea. So that, you know, we go to restaurants, we see swordfish, we see tuna, we see crab meat, we see shrimp, we see salmon, we see a couple of varieties of flatfish. We're not seeing much of these other species. I think chefs have to start utilizing them. We've got to start putting them on restaurant menus.
And many chefs are, and hopefully, you know, we'll continue the trend, you know, because it's sort of that starts with the chef and then it comes to the consumer. People right. buy it and people ask for it. You know, we're going to have a lot more impact. This impetus and this ball is going to roll. I mean, the other thing is that, unfortunately, most Americans like their fish, and again, I'm making an overreaching statement here. They want it to look like steak.
They want steak. They don't want bones. They don't want skin.
No bones.
No head. I don't want to look at that thing.
They don't want to see anything that resembles what the animal once was. They want it to be large enough to perhaps hang over the edge of their plate at Red Lobster.
Right.
And those species are the reason that you have, you know, such pressure on salmon and tuna and swordfish and these sort of these larger pelagic animals. So. If you get used to the idea of eating less, first of all, 6-7 ounces of protein is more than enough for any human being at a single sitting. And if you get comfortable with the idea of eating the fish with the bones on it, you know, working around a little bit, putting a little more effort into it, makes it so interesting. It's so communal. There's this, you know, you're a big crab cracker, I'm sure, in the best possible sense of that word. Down in Jersey, and when we do the same thing along on in summertime, when you have a good season of crabs, when you sit around the table and you crack crabs, there's something that sort of magic that happens, right? It isn't, and the same thing when you're grilling, you know, 2 or 3 little porgies, and you've got to sort of work around some of the bones. One of the most incredible pieces of fish I had all summer was something I got by accident, and that was a bluefish collar. I mean, think of bluefish as fatty and large and scary, and you're like, okay, so what's the fattiest part of the animal? The belly up by the head, the collar. So why would you want the fattiest part of an already fatty and oily fish? Well, I'll tell you, I would barbecue these collars and treat them like ribs. Cure them a little bit, put some strong flavors, a little bit of sweetness, and, you know, barbecue it. And it was... Mm. And I didn't discover it until someone said, oh, yeah, you know, some of the prep cooks at my restaurant said, don't throw those heads away, we want them. So I could go into... Pretty much any trash can.
Were immigrants. I bet you the prep kids were probably kids from outside of America.
They were Mexican.
Yeah.
Probably, this is at Nick and Tony's, and they're all from Puebla, I think. I could go to any fish dock, especially in the summer, and the first thing that they're going to throw away are those massive bluefish heads. I have a friend who goes, he calls it dumpster diving for tuna. I mean, there's so much tuna that goes in the garbage in and around the head, and it's the best part, by the way. That collar and that shoulder meat and, you know, all that stuff. If we just get a little bit more used to sort of working around some of that stuff, we would be, you know, in heaven. I mean, you think of the trends towards everyone who loves this head-to-tail eating on the pork. You know, if bluefish were pigs, there'd be no problem. We'd all be fed very well because it'd be trendy enough that everyone, you know, with a tattoo and a nose ring would want to, like, find out a way to, like, butcher a whole bluefish and use the eyes and all that stuff. But unfortunately, you know, it hasn't gotten quite that cachet yet.
Yeah, I think it's the last – I think fish is sort of the last frontier for American consumers.
And for reason, too. I mean, you go underwater and you are in an alien universe. It feels very difficult to us. You know, it's not something
that
we can
drive by farms. We kind of see what cows look like on the pasture. We've seen chickens in a coop if they're free range. We get it. We get vegetables. We know where they come from. But yeah, these fishermen and fisherwomen are basically the farmers of the sea. They cruise out on these boats. We don't see them for 6 to 10 days most of the time. We don't know where the hell they're going. It's black, it's dark, it's gnarly, it's risky, and they come back with this stuff, and we're just disconnected from it as a culture.
And even when they're catching it, they're somewhat disconnected because it happens, you know, deep, dark places underwater at the end of lines.
Right.
You know, unless you're a spear fisherman in the environment, you're doing it, you know, by virtue of, what you've learned.
You know. That's right.
Of what you've learned. And it's still very mysterious. I mean, that's the other thing about fish is that a lot of what happens, even when it comes back, it happens in dark places at night, stinky fish houses, you know, whatever. It's just got this reputation of not being this pristine, bright, clean animal.
And I mean, you know, to the mystery of the whole thing, I mean, think about how many other food items that we're harvesting where you're going to be competing with other apex predators just to get that thing out of the water, to get it onto the boat. You know, it's
the bear are not chasing the cattle.
Yeah, it doesn't happen too often as far as I know. But
no, it's the last wild food. And soon to be, you know, less and less of it. If we don't start being a little bit more, you know, mindful and careful. There are still great success stories. There's lots to be happy about.
Even Patagonian toothfish. You know, that they had a certification. Who's that? The
MSC.
MSC.
Marine Stewardship.
Had them on the radio here a while ago. And that's, you know, they went down there and worked with some of the fishermen and the bigger fleets, and they said, hey, if you manage this fisheries and we have put this stamp on it, you can get 30% more than you're selling it for now. And they got them to sort of get that fish to rebound, because that was another one that would bass.
Yeah, that's exactly.
It was just a little bit of marketing pizzazz in there, too.
But smart. I mean, this is what it's going to take on all angles, because, you know, there's Chinese boats.
Well, we were
just talking
about the other day how some of the names of these fish are even enough to get people to not want to buy them.
Yeah, who wants dogfish? Anyone dogfish? Dogfish? No?
Right,
no dogfish?
Or sheep's head, you know? I mean, they're not like appetizing names.
Blowfish tails, right?
I mean, that's sea squabs. That's how sea squabs came about.
So good. So good.
And they come and go in ways we don't even understand. I mean, there's seasons when they're great in spring and fall, and seasons when they're non-existent.
Good luck with the show, guys. Good luck with the show. This sounds great.
Thank you.
No, this sounds really... Keep me posted.
Yeah, for sure.
Sounds like so much fun.
We've got to get you on the boat.
Yeah.
Get me on the boat. I don't know what the hell. Bring me on as ballast. Jaws. I don't usually puke, but I'm not much good at fishing. But I'll bring humor to the table.
You'll bring your warmth and charm. Come on,
warmth, charm, and I'll help you eat and maybe even cook. Give me a knife.
I'd like that.
Curry Hefford, and you'll see him on Top Chef this week. Next week,
Wednesday at 10.
Wednesday at 10. Good friends with Tom Colicchio. They go way back. You guys worked together at Mondrian, is that correct?
We worked together at Mondrian. We met in the south of France just before I came back to open Montrachet in 1986.
Wow. Yeah. Which kitchen?
We were in Virgin? Gascony. No, it was in Gascony at Ariane Dagan's father, the Hotel de France.
Yeah.
And he was stuck. Ariane told me, he says, I've got one guy over there right now. He's from New Jersey. He doesn't speak so much French, but, you know, maybe you can help him. So I go there, and there's this guy with his guitar and all this luggage and no clue as to how to deal with these, like, little wiseacre French commis who are playing tricks on him every day and all this stuff. So I come in there with my French, and we take the kitchen over. We start, you know, running specials on the menu. We beat the crap out of those little commis. We started drinking the white Armagnac right out of the bottle at 150 proof first thing in the morning. We took the owner's car to Spain and got lost and almost got arrested and all that good stuff. We had adventures.
It's fun. It's so funny because when D'Artagnan launched, their launch party was at the Maurice, and I was the sous chef of Christian Delouvrier at that time.
He's a big friend.
Oh, he's a great guy. One of my mentors. So I was 2.5 years his sous chef at the Maurice. Got to work with Alessandro's at that point. But I remember this. We were invaded by that whole kitchen. They brought the dad came over and Ariane came over.
Oh,
and now
dad
she's
is
celebrating.
Massive
guy.
Yeah, he was 6'4". This
well, Ariane's big.
This rugby player, this ambassador of all things Southern French. He would walk through the market, and I swear the geese would part in his way like Moses in the Red Sea. And it was just this most amazing thing.
And she's celebrating 30 years with that business.
30 years.
This is the year 19. 2015 will be a 30th
year. Yeah, they got a new plant
business.
In Jersey City, and they're moving, and they're gonna it's gonna be awesome.
I'll have her on the show in a couple of weeks, I think. All right. Curry Heffernan's been my guest. Curry, thanks so much for coming in. You can watch him on Top Chef next week. You could watch Gimme It. Hooked on Seafood is the name of the episode.
Correct. On Eat, the Story of Food on Nat Geo.
And Paul Bryant is a producer for what we hope will be a series that gets picked up by somebody out there in cable land that'll shed a light on what we've been talking about today in terms of interesting fish, fisheries, how it's done. I mean, the pilot looks killer. Underwater action. You're great. You eat up the camera. Good luck with that, boys.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break and come back. Well, you'll see. Quick break and we'll come back. Stay tuned. There's more. So if you want to make a great tomato sauce, where do you start? You start with great canned tomatoes. And what are the best? What's the gold standard? What do the best Italian restaurants use, you think? San Marzano tomatoes from southern Italy. You know, I've heard of San Marzano tomatoes, loved them, heard the whole legend thing, knew they were delicious, but I wanted to go visit the region. So sometime back, I don't know, 06, 07, we went to San Marzano in the middle of the packing season in August. They've got a really long growing season. Starts early spring, April, May, and runs all the way through October because the weather down there is beautiful. You're along the coastline of Naples there in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius, and these are really small family farms, really small, like a half an acre apiece, and that's how they make a living, is harvesting these tomatoes. But what makes them great is the typicity of everything, the style of the tomato. It's kind of a long tomato with a really thin skin, super fleshy, super sweet tasting off the vine. We can Cento San Marzano tomatoes in the prime of the season, which is August. They just slow production down, hand pick everything. Those little basil leaves, yeah, they're all put in there by hand as well. It is the best canned tomato I've ever had, and you're going to love them too. There's a reason chefs love these things. They're San Marzano authorized from the beginning. The factory gets inspected every year. Hey, you want to make great tomato sauce at home? Start with great tomatoes. Cento San Marzano. That's what I use. Hey, folks. Mike Colomeco here. Years back when I had my own restaurant, I had to figure out what kind of oils to use, you know, try to make money in the restaurant business. So, you know, the most expensive oil wasn't the choice, but I had to use an oil that was great, an oil that I would use at home and also for my customers. Came upon Colavita olive oil, which to this day still stands head and shoulders above everybody in that extra virgin category in the supermarket shelves. So much of the extra virgin category is dominated by labels that sound like they're Italian. You know, they end with an O or something like that. But the truth is they're tank farm blends that come out of Italy, but what's in the jar or the can is oils from all over the world that are just spot on price. It's commodity oils. Colavita is the only one that's an extra virgin that's 100% Italian origin traceable. It's a great company. They really built their brand on the U.S. market. They get the U.S. market. So if you're looking for a super extra virgin olive oil, use the one that I've been using for years on my table at home and in my restaurants wherever I was hanging my chef's toque, and that would be Colavita Extra Virgin. True Italian, great oil. So my first trip to Portugal was 2013. It was a wine trip. A bunch of us flew over and toured the country top to bottom. Fell in love with the place. The food, the wine, the scenery, everything. Had to come back, which I did in 14 to film. And this time, 8 days in country, top to bottom again. Food, wine, surfing, what's not to love? If you've never been to Portugal, it's an extraordinary place. Buffered on one side by the Atlantic Ocean, you've got great seafood, great wines growing in all those regions. You go a little inland, you've got more great food, incredible wine country. Of course, Port is the birthplace of Ports up the Douro. But my takeaway was, I thought I'd had a lot of varietals. I could keep a list of 130, 135 varietals I've had over my life. Portugal has 250 of its own indigenous wine varietals.
And they're killer good. A lot of them growing there for centuries. It has some of the oldest viticulture in Europe. The sparkling wines from the Bijada, the great reds coming down south from those regions. What's not to love? Crisp whites, beautiful full-bodied reds, port wine, sparkling wine. So if you're not familiar with the wines of Portugal, next time you stop by at your local wine store, ask about them. I love them. I'm drinking a lot of them these days, and I think you will too.
Hey, folks, welcome back. Mike Kalameka here. You're listening to Food Talk. We're going to travel outside of the New Yorker metro area for just a bit. I'm allowed to do this, right? We're going to travel to Peru. Well, kind of. My guest in studio is Melanie Asher. She's a producer of Pisco, which is like the national drink of Peru. Tell me how you got in the business, because it's a great story. And then tell me about the business, because there's a kind of a female focus to this business.
So it's a little bit crazy, but at the age of 12, I put some Pisco in my ice cream, and it took off from there. And it's a crazy dream that I had as a childhood kid to take Pisco to the world. And I did it. You know, I went to business school. I worked on Wall Street for banks. But Peru kept calling me back. I was
born in Peru. Mom's Peruvian?
Yes.
Dad American?
Yes.
Okay. Let's just back this up for the audience that is wondering what is Pisco?
So Pisco?
Pisco 101.
So Pisco is the oldest spirit of the Americas. And it is the only spirit in the world that is made all naturally. So I thought, hey, this needs to have a place in the world stage. How does no one know about it? So 10 years ago, Michael, I basically started a company with my sister, and we decided to bring quality Pisco to America. So hence Machu Pisco was born.
So that's the brand name.
Yes.
Machu Pisco. What's the base for Pisco then? What are you distilling?
It's a grape brandy.
So we're starting with wine?
Yes.
And then we're sending the wine through an alembic?
Yes.
So out of that alembic, we're getting a clear liquid.
Exactly.
At that point, it would be an eau de vie, for want of a better term.
Exactly.
Then what happens?
So by law, Peruvian has very strict standards in terms of what can be considered a Peruvian Pisco. And there are only 100 producers. I'm one of them, actually the only female producer, master distiller.
You are?
Yes.
Kudos.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's a great pride. We work with grape growers that are a women cooperative and that handpick the grapes. It's
win-win-win.
Yeah.
And what's the grape varietal? Is it a specific varietal?
It's a Quebranta grape from Peru, and it is similar akin to the Mission grape from California.
So it's a table grape?
Yes.
In a way. I mean,
yes, it is.
Because there is no viticulture that I know of in Peru.
Exactly.
There's no winemaking. So it's a grape that at some point, years and years ago, when was the alembic first introduced to Peru?
So the first trace that we have of the word Pisco in written form in Peru is 1613. So it was nearly 400 years ago when an hacienda owner gave a pot of Pisco, a ceramic vessel, to one of his workers. When he died and he passed away, he left that to her.
Interesting. I wonder how the alembic got to South America.
So it got to South America via the Moors.
That's how it got to Spain.
Yeah, exactly.
And the Moors were using it for medicinal reasons because they were using herbs and distillates and making medicine. And then the Spanish got a hold of it and said, I bet you we could do something else with this. And then it went to France, and we have the birth of all the brandies and eau de vies and cognacs and armagnacs as a result.
Well, yeah, the Moors actually were using it to find the fountain of youth, an elixir. Which the Spaniards adopted and
brought
to Peru.
They didn't find the fountain of youth, and we found booze. So that's what. I keep interrupting you. This is a bad interview. I'm terrible. I've done this before. So out of this alembic comes this distillate.
Mm-hmm.
Is it distilled once or twice?
It's once.
Okay, like Armagnac. So a single distillation.
Exactly.
Then what happens to that clear brandy?
It is by law rested for 3 months. So,
but no oak. I see no color in
this. There's no oak, and we are not allowed to do it to preserve the terroir and really the taste of the grapes. As I was saying, there are very strict guidelines in terms of what makes a Pisco producer, and we have to rest it for 3 months. We can't age it in wood. It has to be stainless steel, and we cannot add any sulfites to it, so you get no hangover from Peruvian Pisco. So my name's on the back of the bottle. You can take me to town to that.
Hangover from sulfites, sir. But I think if you drank enough, you get a hangover. What's the proof? 80, 86?
It's 80.
80 proof.
So my sister and I have drank a whole bottle between the two of us to claim this. So I've put you to the test.
Good. You can hang with me anytime. That's pretty good. So how is it normally consumed? What's the traditional method of consumption in Peru? Because, I mean, you can, when I think of people drink things neat in a snifter, people might put an ice cube on them, they drink them room temperature, cold, warmed, and then we'll get into the cocktail world.
Sure,
but how
course.
Is it consumed? If I'm in a typical Peruvian restaurant or household and I have Pisco around, what am I doing with it?
Okay, so one of the laws is it's distilled to proof, and it's the only spirit in the world that's distilled to proof.
Well, that's interesting.
Yes.
Because normally they come out much higher and either have to be watered down or wait forever for the angel share to evaporate.
Exactly. So what we say as a producer is we work so hard to not add any water, so why add any ice to it at tableside? So as Peruvians, we drink it straight. And the other form is in the Pisco Sour, which is a national cocktail of Peru.
Tell us about the Pisco Sour.
Oh, the Pisco Sour is a magical drink.
Because I know there's been, it's kind of tried to make its way into New York. I know there were Pisco events and Pisco, a couple of years ago they were doing Pisco Sour programs in restaurants. Talk about it.
So the Pisco Sour is a magical drink. Every alcohol has its own buzz, but there's something about the Pisco Sour just makes you nice and happy. It's a light, breezy happiness. And I think there's something about the combination there. But it was invented by an American, Victor Morris, who after Prohibition was out of job, out of work, so he went down to Peru and started bartending, created his own bar, the Morris Bar, and invented the Pisco Sour based on the Whiskey Sour recipe, just replacing the whiskey for Pisco.
So for those of us that are not mixologists by trade, how is a classic Whiskey Sour is made how?
Classic Whiskey Sour is whiskey with sour mix, which is lime and simple syrup.
Okay.
Shaken with an egg white.
So fresh lime juice, simple syrup.
And egg whites.
Egg whites shaken over ice.
And poured.
Then poured with those little strainery things. So it's going to be a little bit cloudy, a little bit foamy.
Yes.
And have a balance of acid from the lime juice, sweetness that's neutral from the simple syrup, and then Pisco at its core.
Yes.
Actually, that does sound great. What do you garnish that with?
With a little bit of Angostura bitters.
I can see the popularity of that. I can see it. So your whole organization, top to bottom, is female-run.
Yes.
You are, what's your title?
I'm founder and CEO.
And your sister?
Is the president.
President. And who makes the wine? Who actually supervises?
I actually do. So after business school, I went down to Peru and learned for 3 years how to make Pisco. And started working with a women's cooperative. We have the same grapes every year, make the same wine. And I will essentially sit next to the alembic 8 hours a day as we distill the wine. And make sure I have the same consistency year after year.
Gas-fired or wood-fired? I'm just curious. The alembic.
So when I started 10 years ago, it was wood-fired.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I mean, that's old school.
It's old school. And when I started, there used to be a press by feet. So we did it Lucille Ball sort of way.
Well, the only place that's happening that I know of, and even there it's not much, is in Port, in the Douro.
And it's tough work.
No, it's ridiculously hard work. I mean, people think that's fun. No, because the repetitive movement and it's your knees are coming up and down. It's a lot of work. And for the most part, they've replaced it in the Douro with a machine that's a little rubber thing that looks like a foot that's kind of like soft and like they spent a lot of money to figure out how to make like prosthetic fake feet coming down with the same pressure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, those...
So it's still done that way, but you still do it that way.
So I do that for my luxury Pisco, which I only make 200 bottles for. And that is the La Diablada Pisco. And the Machu Pisco is made in much more commercial fashion in terms of we do pneumatic press. But it's something that we still do for both Piscos is a gravity press where the grapes press themselves and do a single grape pressing.
Can you taste the difference? I mean, you're going to say yes, but what's the noticeable difference between the really limited run of 200 bottles, 200 cases by foot, and your one that we were selling here?
So it's when you do a feet pressing, you get much more of the grape essence because you're not getting as much contact with the skin and the stems and the stalks with actual juice. Mm. So it's much more of a single grape pressing.
Mm-hmm. Pisco's consumed widely throughout Peru. It's like your national thing. Mm-hmm. Tell me a bit, because Americans, myself included, I've been throughout Europe. You know, I've got stamps from all over Europe, you know, 50 times. I know the back roads of France. I could drive around Italy. I haven't been to South America yet. I've been as far south as Costa Rica, but that's not South America. That's Central America. Tell me about Peruvian food culture.
So right now, Peruvian gastronomy is at an all-time boom, you know, with the ceviches and with Astrida Gaston, the restaurant, being named top 50 in the world. It's really getting a renaissance right now with top chefs around the world that are Peruvian and spreading the Peruvian gastronomic gospel. So
so you're known for ceviche. You've got like 75 varieties of potatoes.
So it is like the Paris of South America, Lima is. We have such great variety because we've had Spaniards, Spaniard immigrants. We've had the Italians. We've had Africans. We've had Chinese. We've had Japanese. So the confluence
Nobu. Nobu at one point worked in Peru.
Exactly.
An inspiration for some of his dishes today on all of his menus is his time in Peru.
Yeah. His signature is a tiradito, which is a form of ceviche that's like a sashimi with a little bit of lemon juice. And really, I mean, just having the whole mixture of all the cultures into one is fantastic. And that translates into pisco. You know, the Spaniards brought the grapes. Italians brought the process of how to really make wine and make a better wine. So it's really every product of Peru has something from all over the world.
Great coastline.
Oh, beautiful surfing. Great
so I hear. Surfing. I have got friends that went down, actually. They were said the waves are actually can be too big, like really, really serious surfing.
Yeah.
Water can be a little cold.
Freezing the Pacific Ocean.
Yes, wetsuit stuff, which is why I'm always like, I hate putting on a wetsuit. I'm old and tight, and putting on a wetsuit makes it even worse. So where do we find... We can buy this in the States.
Yeah, you can buy it here in New York, Astor Food and Astor Spirits.
Astor Wine. That's where on Astor Place. It's one of the most iconic New York stores.
Yes.
And you also had an idea you were going
to
make...
Oh, in Brooklyn. Sorry to interrupt you. In Brooklyn, you have Drink Up New York, which is nearby.
Do you sell much in the States? Can't be a too big a market because it's not that well known.
So, Michael, this is a...
You're going to have to change
this
that.
This is a labor of love. You know, my sister and I really dedicated this to this business because we really see a future in giving back to Peru where we're from. But the sales are right now nascent. It's growing. But it's a niche artisanal product that we make and want to like continue having the authenticity of what we're making in an old-fashioned way. And a tribute a bit to, I didn't tell you this, but my grandmother, she's 99 years old. She
God bless, still around.
Turning 100 May 17th. So we'll be making a collection item for her because she swears drinking her pisco every night has made her find the fountain of youth.
We knew that alembic would come in handy for some reason.
Yes.
Well, this is an interesting, I would imagine if your marketing team and you do your job right, with the amazing interest in mixology and the whole cocktail boom in America, you know, mixologists, bartenders, whatever you want to call them, are looking for some niche ingredients. I mean, who knew that mezcal would have taken off?
Oof,
who knew
big
that
time.
L'Absinthe, we'd be making it on the West Coast? I mean, who are these sort of niche ingredients are what mixologists are fascinated by?
Oh, and you know, I think that's been really spurring the growth for our brand because we've got mixologists like Jim Meehan
PDT.
From PDT that got behind it.
He's one of the great pioneers.
who used to be at Death & Co. and now is at Pouring Ribbons. Megan Dorman from Dear Irving just opened up. And I love seeing what these guys and gals are doing. Completely different stuff other than the Pisco Sour.
Of course, because they're just looking at it and then thinking completely out of the box the way they do and the way they've sort of transformed how other ingredients have found their way into cocktail culture. This may be the first time I've had Pisco. How embarrassing is that? But I'll be honest with you. Yeah.
You know, I
still, so I'm not, this bottle, I don't know if it has my name on it, but if it doesn't, yes, I may
it
steal
does,
it.
It does have your name.
You may not take this out of the studio today. Thanks so much for coming in. So it's a great story. All women run business.
Yes.
Women, a cooperative who you're buying the grapes from, a classic Peruvian drink, Pisco. My guest has been Melanie Asher. The name of the brand is Machu Pisco. You can't miss it. It's got a little kind of greenish, lime green mountain on the label with some brown stuff and kind of artsy homemade stuff. And what's this little award? What's this thing?
So,
94 points from somebody.
So Paul Picault gave us...
Oh, Paul Picault. I know Paul.
Yeah, he's fantastic.
He's great.
And he gave us 94 points for best Pisco for Pisco Sour. So can't get better than that. It's... $20 a bottle, so affordable.
Oh, that's and, thanks for throwing that out, yeah. Because I didn't ask that question. That's really affordable.
Exactly.
Great. And you're saying you're doing great work down there supporting a cooperative of women, your business. It's great. Thanks for introducing me. And you made me a drink. Tell me what you made me, because it wasn't a Pisco Sour.
Sure.
Just walk me through it, because it's great. It's kind of like a Manhattan.
Yes. So I'm in New York this week, so I thought it would be appropriate to make you the proven version of the Manhattan, which is called El Capitan, and it's equal portions of Machu Pisco, red vermouth, and some bitters thrown in. We stir it and then serve it straight up. It's delicious.
I can attest to that. I've been drinking one the whole program. You could kind of hear my mouth watering. It's great. And I love these drinks that are like equal parts, too. It's great. I'm a Campari guy. I'm a Negroni guy forever. A Negroni just 1-1-1, three ingredients on ice, orange, bitter. I love all that stuff. So it's got sweet vermouth, which I love.
Yes.
I may try to make the same thing at home with Antique Formula, which has seen some oak on it. Give it a little bit of nuance.
Yes, and you can use whatever vermouth you want per your liking.
Yes, and if you want, you could. I guess you could probably serve this the way you did, mixed and poured. And then if you wanted to get wonky, you could put one of those big ice cubes in it that just doesn't melt, that holds the temperature.
Yes.
You know those custom ice cubes they make nowadays? That's kind of like how they
and
do
a little bit
stuff.
Of an orange peel on top.
I'm thinking, because I'm like the burner, and maybe even burn that orange, get some of those orange esters in there.
Nice.
We're creating our own drink. All right, we got to stop.
That'll be the Brooklyn.
It'll be the Brooklyn version. No, the Lower East Side. I'm not from Brooklyn. Hey, my guest has been Melanie Asher up from Peru. Great to have you in the studio. Machu Pisco is the beverage we're talking about. Get it at Astor. Get it in Brooklyn. Google it. You'll find it. It's pretty darn delicious, I have to attest. First time I've had it, based on a grape brandy from the Cabranta grape. Run through an alembic, 3 months in stainless steel, and then it's your baby to drink. Thanks so much for coming in. Enjoy your week in New York.
Thank you, Michael. Salud.
Hey, salud. Take care. We'll be back with more of Food Talk right after this. Yeah, well, maybe not. We've used up an hour. Sorry about that, folks. Great interviews. Great to have Curry in. Great to talk about fish sustainability. Great to drink some Pisco. It was wonderful. We'll be back next week. We've got a whole roster of guests through the month of January that are great. Stay tuned. We'll be back live for the next 4 weeks at least. I think we're going to the Philippines in February a bit. But stay tuned. See you next week. Have a great week. Happy New Year. And we'll be back.
The song for Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is Real Long Way to Go by Brothers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.